has never abrogated, though most of our states have abrogated. He that smiteth a man so that he die shall be surely put to death, and if a man lie not in wait, but God deliver him into his hand, then I will appoint him a place to which he shall flee. But if a man come presumptuously upon his neighbor to slay him with guile, thou shalt take him from mine altar, that he may die. So here is your law of asylum. A man seeking safety from those who say he's committed murder when he hasn't can flee to the altar. And we find in 1 Kings 1:50 an instance where a man did that. Remember where Adonijah ran and took hold on the horns of the altar and Solomon said, drag him out and kill him, and they did so. Then the second stage in this is found in Deuteronomy 19. In Deuteronomy 19, according to the critics, this is the second code. Deuteronomy 19, verses 1 to 13. This is a fairly long passage, as is rather natural from their viewpoint, because there is now a great change that has taken place. No longer, once the Deuteronomic law has been put into effect, and all sacrifices required to be performed at Jerusalem, no longer are there altars scattered throughout the land providing a place of asylum. And therefore, it is necessary to make a new provision for asylum. And so here we find in Deuteronomy that the new provision is given, the second stage. When the Lord thy God hath cut off the nations whose land the Lord thy God giveth thee, and thou succeedest them and dwellest in their cities and in their homes, thou shalt set apart 3 cities for thee in the midst of thy land, which the Lord thy God giveth thee to possess. Thou shalt prepare thee a way and divide the borders of thy land, which the Lord thy God giveth thee to inherit, into 3 parts, that every slayer may flee there. And this is the case of the slayer who shall flee there, that he may live, whoso killeth his neighbor unintentional, whom he hated not in time past. As when a man goes into the forest with his neighbor to hew wood, and his hand swings with the axe to cut down the tree, and the head slips from the helve and lights on his neighbor that he dies, he shall flee unto one of these cities and live, lest the avenger of blood pursue the slayer while his heart is hot and overtake him, because the way is long and slay him. Whereas he was not worthy of death, inasmuch as he hated him not in time past. Wherefore I command thee, saying, thou shalt set apart 3 cities for thee. And if the Lord thy God enlarge thy border as he hath sworn unto thy fathers, and give thee all the land which he promised to give unto thy fathers, if thou shalt keep all these commandments to do them which I command thee this day, to love the Lord thy God and to walk ever in his ways, then shalt thou add 3 more cities for thee, beside these 3. That innocent blood be not shed in thy land, which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance, and so blood be upon thee. But if any man hate his neighbor, and lie in wait for him, and rise up against him, and smite him mortally that he die, and fleeth unto one of these cities, then the elders of his city shall send and fetch him from thence, and deliver him unto the hand of the avenger of blood, that he may die. Thine eye shalt not pity him, but thou shalt put away the guilt of innocent blood from Israel, that it may go well with thee. Now you see how much more detailed, how much more lengthy the second commandment regarding asylum is. And according to the critical view, it is necessary, because it is a new thing. It is an innovation. With all the altars to be destroyed, the priest or whoever wrote the book of Deuteronomy realized that this would cause great trouble in the land, because the people would no longer have a place to flee when they hadn't committed murder but were thought to have done so. And therefore, he makes this provision and explains it in detail, it being a new thing. Well, that's the second stage in it, and they're to set aside 3 cities, you know. But then you turn to Numbers 35, 9 to 34. There you get a section which the critics give to the P document. Numbers 35, 9 to 34, and there you find this long statement, which I will not read to you now. It is substantially the same law as was given in Deuteronomy in the section that I read to you, But it is much more detailed. And in verse 13 it says, or in verse 11 it says, then ye shall appoint to you cities to be cities of refuge. In verse 13 it says, six cities shall ye have for refuge. 14, ye shall give three cities on this side of the Jordan, and three cities shall ye give in the land of Canaan. These six cities shall be a refuge for the children of Israel and for the strength. And so you see, the P document, the later, is much more detailed, much more complicated, much more extensive, and it increases it to six cities instead of three. So unlike the original matter of the division of the question of where they are to have to sacrifice, in which we really only have two stages, here you have three. First, the altar. Second, three cities of refuge. Third, six cities of refuge. Thus, the development from simple to more complex. Now, over in Joshua 20, it tells how, after they conquered Canaan, they set aside six cities for this purpose. And these six cities are named. And the latter part of chapter 20, this also is supposed to be part of the P document. And verse 9 says, these were the cities assigned for all the children of Israel and for the stranger who sojourns among them, that whosoever killeth any person without intent might flee there and not die by the hand of the avenger of blood until he stood before the congregation. Yes, Mr. Osborne is calling our attention to Deuteronomy 4:41-43, which says that Moses set aside three cities in Transjordan. But the critics say that that is a section from the P document. All the rest of the chapter, and the chapters immediately before and after, are part of the D document. But this was inserted in the D document. It represents the later stages, the P document, according to the critics here. Yeah. Very good point, one that we would normally look at under a later head of the examination of the brethren, now when we're merely presenting. But a very interesting point in that connection. Mr. Osborne?
Yes, this is Deuteronomy 4:20,
yeah. 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 Very interesting point. Yes. No mention. We will go on to look later under another head at examination. At present, I'm simply wanting to present the critical argument on the development, the alleged development. Sometimes I've handled it this way, sometimes I've handled it by taking each point, looking at the point, and then looking at arguments for and against. This year, I thought I would have be the statement of the principal features of the argument. So we're stating the features of the argument as presented by the critic. Maybe that term isn't very good. The principal feature of the argument might sound as if it meant both sides of it. So maybe if we say the principal features of the argument of the critic, that will make clear that I meant to leave till C of the careful examination. B then, statement of the principal features of the argument of the critic, or perhaps of the critical view would be better yet. Well, now there's another important phase of the critic's argument, which I'd like to look at and then take up the consideration of the critical argument to see just how much or how little real grounding it has. So number two here was the centralization of the place of sacrifice, and I looked at the law of asylum under that head. Number three will be the argument regarding the persons who could perform the sacrifice. Regarding the persons who could perform the sacrifice. The critical argument has about institutions. Israelite institutions looks at dozens of institutions and tries to show the different stages of J, of E, of D, and of P. And a great many of the arguments are very weak and very vague. But the two strongest are the two which deal with the place of sacrifice and with the persons who can perform the sacrifice. And so I'm concentrating most of our attention on those. And this one on the persons who could perform the sacrifice, in other words, those who came to be called priests, as we look at that under number 3. And instead of, as in the case of number 2, looking at their central argument, Deuteronomy, and then looking what's before and after, this time I'm going to look at them in chronological order, as the critic told us. Small a, then, is the alleged attitude of J and E. The alleged attitude of J and E. Now, there's a very good statement of this in Carpenter's book on the composition of the Hexateuch, from which I've read to you a number of times lately. And this we find on page 87 of his book, where he says, another important series of divergences is connected with the ministry at the sanctuary. To whom was this entrusted and under what condition? The code which opens with the recognition of a plurality of altars in Exodus, that is the covenant code, Exodus 20-23, lays down no rules concerning their service. Nor do the covenant words of 34 assign the right of sacrifice to any special class of sacred persons. See, no priesthood in J.E. is their claim. He goes on to give illustrations. In the tent of meeting outside the camp, chapter 33, verse 11, Joshua, an Ephraimite, minister of Moses, was appointed to its custody and remained in it when Moses himself used to return to the camp. According to Deuteronomy 10:8, after the death of Aaron at several stages from the sacred mount, the tribe of Levi was set apart to carry the covenant. Now you see, this is the next stage. This is small b, the alleged attitude of D. You have Joshua, an Ephraimite, in the tent of meeting with Moses. In the first one, you have Abraham offering sacrifice, Isaac sacrificing, Jacob sacrificing, any head of a family offering a sacrifice in Genesis. That doesn't say in Genesis anywhere. You have to be a descendant of Aaron in order to offer sacrifice. It doesn't say anywhere in Genesis you have to be belong to the tribe of Levi to offer sacrifice. You'll find all sorts of people in Genesis offering sacrifice. So the critical view is that in J and E, anybody, any head of a family could offer sacrifice. But now the next stage, he says, according to Deuteronomy 10:8, after the death of Aaron, the tribe of Levi was set apart to carry the ark. For instance, it's not stated who would carry this up to that time. And to stand before Yahweh to serve him. Within this tribe, D recognizes no distinctions of rank. All Levites possess the priesthood and have equal rights of ministry. And there he refers to Deuteronomy 18:1-7. Deuteronomy 18:1-7. Deuteronomy frequently speaks about the Levitical priests. Let's look at 18:1-7. The Levitical priests, that is all the tribe of Levi, shall have no part nor inheritance with Israel. They shall eat the offerings of the Lord made by fire and his inheritance. Therefore shall they have no inheritance among their brethren. The Lord is their inheritance, as he hath said unto them, and this shall be the priest's due from the people. From them who offer a sacrifice, whether it be ox or sheep, they shall give unto the priest the shoulder and the two cheeks and the stomach. The first fruit also of thy grain, of thy wine, of thine oil, and the first of the fleece of thy sheep shalt thou give him. For the Lord thy God hath chosen him out of all thy tribes to come to minister in the name of the Lord, he and his son forever. So you see, there is mention of the Levitical priests, mention of the Levites, but no specific mention in the book of Deuteronomy of the descendants of Aaron. So they say the second stage is the limiting of sacrifice to Levites, to descendants of the of Levi, members of that particular tribe. Then small c, the attitude of P. But in the service of the dwelling, fresh distinctions are introduced. The priesthood is limited to Aaron and his house, Exodus 28. The sacred vestments are perpetually ordained for him and for his seed after him. 28:43. The priests in general are designated Aaron's sons. Leviticus 1:5. The responsibility for the holy office falls on them alone. Numbers 18:1. Theirs is the charge of sanctuary and altar. And any attempted usurpation of this privilege will involve death. Of this terrible doom, a conspicuous example is afforded in the fate of Korah and his 250 followers in Numbers 16. What remains then for the rest of the tribe of Levi? So you see the three stages as the critics hold. J and E, sacrificed by any head of a family. D, sacrifice limited to the Levites. P, sacrifice limited to the family of Aaron, who are called the priests. And this latest, according to the critics' latest distinction, is still preserved to this day. According to something I read recently, if you go to a synagogue, at least to an Orthodox synagogue in the land of Israel today, they ask you as you come in the door, are you Aaron or Levi or Israel? If you are Aaron or Cohen, a Kohen, a priest, then you have certain standing in the community. In this country, a person who is a descendant of Aaron, a person who is a Kohen, has a standing in some Jewish synagogues ahead of that of the trained rabbi, because he is a descendant of the priestly family. But if you are of Levi, they may ask you to read a certain part of the service or give you special distinction, but not like the distinction of a descendant of Aaron. And if you are Israel, that means you, of course, they're all Israel, and all the Kohanim are Levites. But if you are Israel, you simply mean that you are not one of these who have this special place in the service. Now, they do not perform sacrifice anymore, of course, in Israel or among Jews in this country. And so the distinction made is really not a very important one. It refers to a little special honor given or the opportunity to read something in the service or something like that. But in scriptural times, it was a distinction. The Levites performed service of the sanctuary, had very special religious duties to do, but all sacrifice was under the direction of the priest. Now the critics say these are three stages. J and E, any head of family can offer sacrifice. D, only Levites can do it, and over and over and over in the book of Deuteronomy you read about the Levitical priests. Literally, the priests, the Levites. The Levitical priests. And in the latter part of Exodus, in Leviticus and in Numbers, there are many references to the sons of Aaron and specific statements of the special position allotted to the priests, the descendants of Aaron. You got a question, Dr. Stone?
I was wondering if those bodies have been really preserved. There was no such on the of Aaron, or have
Well, now that's very hard to tell. It's very hard to say. I certainly, as far as I know, the other tribal distinctions have been lost. And people who are not of the tribe of Levi do not know what tribe they come from. The tribes have all been mixed together. But it would not be at all strange if those who had these special privileges did pass the knowledge on from father to son. But I doubt if they could prove it. Yes?
There's no way of telling at all
if they have to. Yeah. Oh, I'm sure of that. But I'm merely saying that if a person belonged to the family of Aaron, it would not be at all strange if the word was passed on from family, father to son. There would be no way to prove whether it had been passed on correctly. There would be no way to prove or disprove a person's claim. But it would be likely that among people that they would have passed it on. Now, they might not in some cases, but I'm sure in some cases they might not, because this was something held of great importance in the family. But in general, the tribal distinctions have been pretty well forgotten. But that doesn't affect our present argument. Our present critical position, then, is a very important part of the critical argument. The reason for three different stages. J and E, anyone can sacrifice. D, sacrifice is limited to the Levites. P, sacrifice is limited to the sons of Aaron. Well, I think this covers, well, no, we've mentioned one other, just as a catch-all. Number three was the arrangement concerning the person who would perform the sacrifice. And we'll simply state as four, that there are many other institutions. I've already stated, but I'll give it a head here. Many other institutions regarding which the critics suggest that there has been a development between different doctrines. But most of these are rather vague and confused, and you do not get any very clear evidence on most of them. They will read laws in Exodus or in Numbers or in Deuteronomy, which will have language somewhat different, and they will say, see how there is a development. But we're not going to go into them because there are dozens of them of which arguments are presented, but none of them are, I'd say, a half as clear as the arguments on these points. Yes, Mr.?
You have learned earlier that the
religious
learning is necessary to the sacrifice.
Yeah. No, no. That is a very good question. Very excellent question. What about the carrying out of these laws? Do we find they were carried out or not? And the strongest critical argument for the different documents under partition, I would say, is the matter of parallel passages. I think we can answer it satisfactorily, but it is the strongest argument they have of their various arguments in that area. The strongest argument that they have in the area of development is the argument from history. That is the claim that a man like Elijah had never heard of any such a law because he proceeded to sacrifice and he sacrificed on Mount Sinai. Now that is a different area, the argument from history. And we're going to look into that rather to a fair extent. It is an argument which, if it were in the forefront of discussion, we would need to take a great deal of time to discuss. But it is not spoken of a great deal now. But it is the hardest argument to answer. And so we will spend considerable time over it, but we'll take it later. But I'm glad to see it occur to your mind at this point, because it is a thing which is very vital. But we will take it up in simply that, in that arrangement, dealing with it later. Now the so much then for B, statement of the alleged statement of the principal features of the critical viewpoint. Now we will then call capital C. We will call capital C examination of the evidence for the alleged development within the doctrine. Examination of the evidence for the alleged development within the doctrine. Now, of course, the evidence for whether these laws were carried out or not, that's another big point to look at later. But now we're interested in the evidence actually within the doctrine for this alleged development. We have glanced at this evidence already. I've called your attention to it. I think I've given you sufficient to show you just what the critical law is and rule is and on what they base their claim. But now we will examine the bases on which they place them. And under this, number one, under this, see, number one is something I've already stated. And so I merely state it, but it's very important, I think, to put at this point. In only one case is a real claim of as many as three stages of development presented. In only one case is a real claim of as many as three stages presented. How many of you could tell us in which case it is that there is a real claim of three deities? How many could tell? Only five or six?
Four.
How many could not tell? There's only two that couldn't tell, and there are eight that could tell. Where is the other stand? They neither could nor couldn't. I would think that everybody should know of one case where there is a real claim. Now, whether everybody would know that's the only one, that is more difficult. But everybody ought to know there is one, because I have just been presenting one within the last 5 minutes. We pointed out that according to the critical claim, there are three stages in the attitude toward the person who could offer sacrifice. Any head of a family could, according to J and E. In Deuteronomy, only the Levites could. And in the P document, only the descendants of Aaron could. We have three stages in this, so everybody should know that there is one case in which the critics make such a claim. But is there any other? Yes?
Yes.
I said a real place. Yeah. They would say there are many places where they'd make a claim. But the difference being simply a difference of having six instead of three, I don't think is enough to show really two stages. It would be suggested there are two stages. But I don't think that's really two stages there. So the statement is a little bit trickily worded, because some critic will take some obscure example and they will make out three or even four stages, but when you examine it, there's practically nothing to it. But when you examine this matter of the priesthood, it sounds fairly strong. It's a real claim, I'd say. As to asylum, whether there were three or six, that is hardly enough to make real stages, I would think. Now, if there's only one case where there's a real claim, there certainly isn't the case of the priest, the people who offer sacrifice. Why isn't there in the case of the place of sacrifice? Why aren't the three stages there? That I dwelt upon at some length last week. The fact there that you have, according to them, any place where the Lord put his name is the J and E stage. Then D is only at the one place the Lord selects. And P assumes it's only one place. There's certainly no claim that there's any difference in the attitude of P toward the place of sacrifice from the attitude of D, except that it isn't stated. It's merely assumed. So as I pointed out then, there are only two stages, really, which are claimed in connection with the place of sacrifice. We have two stages in that, and the asylum goes along with that, of course. And we have three stages in the case of the person. So the fact that there's only, when they claim there are four documents and they show development, that in the important arguments for development of institutions, there's only one of them where there really are three different stages claimed, I think is a matter of considerable importance. Then a great many of the claims, for differences between the doctrines rest heavily upon unwarranted arguments from silence. A great many of the claims of differences between the doctrines rest heavily upon arguments from silence. That I hope you noticed as I read many of these laws. How very frequently the difference rests not upon this being said here and this being said here, but upon this being said here and not mentioned here. For instance, the Levitical priest. Well, all the sons of Aaron were Levitical priests. The fact that you say Levitical priest in one connection and you say sons of Aaron in another doesn't necessarily prove you have different people in mind. It's like if if I am talking to you here about certain people who are from California who have a certain attitudes, and I say, well, these Californians do so and so. But if I am in Europe and speaking about the same people, I might say, well, see what those Americans are doing. Over there, we would use the term American, which couldn't include people from other groups, even though we were speaking in particular of people from a certain state. And in California, they would say, see what these people from Los Angeles are doing. You use different terms, not necessarily meaning that your term includes everybody in the larger term. Well, we look at that more in detail. We will, number three will be specific examination of the material regarding the place of sacrifice. Specific examination of the material regarding the place of sacrifice. And I guess we'll have to wait till tomorrow to look at that in detail. Mr. Lee, you had a question there?
I just wondered if the priest sees that they're not always
four stages. I have not seen any place where they go into that discussion. They simply say, look at these four stages. This says this and this says this. Then they'll say, look at these four stages. This and this and this. But actually, there's no real claim that they present that has three of something.